Online, on digital, and on 103.5 FM. This is 3MBS Fine Music Melbourne.
Welcome to Reflections. I'm Ted Davis, and I'm delighted to welcome a very distinguished guest to my program today. He's Michael Mulcahy, Australian-born and for many years trombonist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, a regular soloist on that instrument, a prominent chamber musician and teacher. I'm particularly looking forward to hearing what it's like playing in one, or rather in several, of the world's great orchestras under some of the world's most celebrated conductors. Welcome to 3MBS, Michael.
Thank you, Ted. My pleasure to be with you.
Now, let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Sydney.
Yes, true.
And music was always part of your early life?
Not at all. It was part of my home life, but it wasn't part of my personal life till I was about 14. My parents were both musicians, and classical music was ubiquitous. It was on from morning till night. All we got was ABC radio and classical music. And as a kid, I wanted to watch the junk, the cartoons and all the garbage. And I was a little starved of that. But in the end, when that music light came on, I had absorbed a lot, you know, unintentionally, passively.
And you were about 14 when that started.
Yes. It was like flicking on a switch. Before then, I was interested in footy, that was all.
Do you remember any particular event that flicked the switch?
I think the thing that made a connection for me was the fact that kids at my school, at that point I was at a Catholic boys' high school, Holy Cross College in Ryde, which is a pretty famous rugby league school, and but they had a very good band as well. And I saw kids who weren't footy people kind of gravitating to the band, and I realized they traveled, they went to competitions, and I started to dabble a little bit. And I went home and told my parents, and they were a little surprised. And I got the bug, but I was a long way behind. I was the worst trombone player I ever met.
I think that's a good cue for your first choice of music.
Thank you.
A Love Song, music of Carl Vine, and the choice of my guest on Reflections today is Michael Mulcahy. Michael, the reason for your choice?
I find this work of Carl's one of the most beautiful original pieces written for the trombone. Very lyrical conception and very magnificent dramatic ending. It's one of my party pieces on recitals and has the great advantage that it doesn't need to be rehearsed with a pianist I've never seen before when I'm travelling. So I have a great love of Carl's music, have for many years, and that led to deeper connections with him as well.
Terrific. Going back to your time in Sydney growing up, so your love affair with the trombone started finally at the age of 14. And were you a good and conscientious student from then?
I was ambitious, conscientious, but I was a late starter. And my dad, who was a trombonist, tried to help me. But unfortunately, being 14, I already knew everything, so he couldn't teach me much. So he found someone that I would keep my mouth shut and listen to. He found me a very old school teacher, a member of the Sydney Symphony, Baden McCarran, and Baden schooled me very strictly. And I'm indebted to him for getting me on the straight and narrow eventually.
And you went to the Sydney Conservatorium?
Yes, after 2 years with Baden, I switched high schools. I'd made some contacts with some other young musicians in Sydney who were both students at the Conservatorium High School. And they kind of recruited me. They said they could really use some trombone players there. And even though I really wasn't very advanced for my age at that point, I did get into the school, and that made a big difference. I kind of took off from there.
And what were you learning in those days? Was it largely technique?
Yeah, it was a mixture, because I'd had dabblings in the brass band movement. I had a few years of that. I was a member of the Willoughby Band as well as the Holy Cross College Band. And so there was the British brass band tradition, which brings you along technically pretty quickly. And then I became aware of the trombone in the orchestra. I'd heard it a lot growing up, but I hadn't really been very aware of its specific role. And so that became a great focus there. So I would say brass band music, then orchestra music, and then a little bit later, towards the end of high school, playing a recital and starting to get my toes wet with solo literature.
And were there any particular composers for the trombone at that time that started to get your attention?
One of them was Beethoven's counterpoint teacher, Albrechtsberger. He was one of those Rococo composers. He and Leopold Mozart, Michael Haydn. There's quite a lot of solo literature from those Salzburg times. And so I started to dabble with the alto trombone, which was the solo instrument of choice, and it was the first thing I learnt on the alto trombone was a concerto, which is not the way you should learn an instrument. I mean, I was really skipping a few steps there, but I started playing that and started standing up, even, you know, very naively and performing it. That was, I think, 1975, 1976, something like that. So that was my first experience with the alto trombone, and I've had an affection for that instrument ever since, and I've also been a soloist with the Chicago Symphony and others, but all on the alto trombone as well, kind of literature.
We'll come to the Chicago in a moment, but in the meantime, your first professional orchestral appointment was with whom?
Tasmanian Symphony. Yes, I was lucky enough to be in the Australian Youth Orchestra for a few seasons and had great time at National Music Camp. So all these doors opened, revelations really, different worlds. And every time I came into a new world, it kind of expanded my vision for what is possible. And even despite the fact there was little evidence to support it, I was very open to the idea that this thing could work out. You know, I didn't have much fear then, and I was a good listener. I could learn. Whenever I was meeting new people, I would be very observant, and I would I would notice what people could do. I could notice how they did it. And so I think I'm a good student in that sense, that I can learn from most situations.
You played with the MSO at that shortly after the Tasmanian Symphony,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, as a kid growing up, I was aware of the fact that there are not many orchestras, there are not many orchestra jobs, there are not many trombone jobs. So one thing I was aware of is there may never be a position that would be open to me, but something did open in Tassie, and I was lucky enough to win it. And I thought, well, this is a beautiful place. This is nice. I went there very young, very green, and I thought I'd be there for many years, but then the MSO opened up, which was unexpected, and I auditioned for it, and I moved to Melbourne not even 6 months after I went to Tassie. I'm still very fond of Tasmania. I've been down there to work for the orchestra, and have many friends there, and actually bought land there, have a nice rural property south of Hobart. So I like to get there when I can. But Melbourne happened, and I was still very young, in both cases, very much a long shot. And I took very big risks at my Melbourne audition, because I knew if I just did a conventional audition at my age, no one would really, I was 18 when I auditioned. I was 19 when I started the job. So on the surface of it, you know, very unseasoned. So I chose repertoire. They gave you a little bit of latitude in terms of your solo pieces, and I chose high-risk pieces. And I also rehearsed with a very good pianist, Bracky Tillis, Israeli pianist who was in Melbourne at that point. And so I was ready to go, and it worked out.
It certainly did. I think it's time for some more music.
Thank you.
Gabrielli's Canzone Due Decimi Toni at 10. And that was a performance by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Brass live. And our guest on Reflection today, Michael Mulcahy, was one of those 10 players. The reason for that choice, Michael?
That is a particularly joyful and florid canzone. Some of the Gabrielli's are a little bit more solemn. This is more brilliant. This puts a smile on everyone's face, but it's very difficult. It's very florid and very dance-like, and it's one of the happiest pieces I know.
It's a great choice. Thank you. So you're in Melbourne. You're playing with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, having taken ridiculous risks at the tender age of 18 or 19. You're in, and you're playing with a professional symphony. Who was the conductor at the time?
The music director was Hiroyuki Iwaki, and he was very kind to me. He was an important connection when I eventually left the orchestra, because he had worked in Germany quite a bit. So eventually when I went there, he was one of the people who vouched for me. But I have some very funny experiences from the beginning, because I was so young. And a couple of them were with Georg Tintner. My very first rehearsal was the Beethoven Fifth, the most famous entry of the trombones into the symphony orchestra. Generally, the trombone had been used in sacred music, but Beethoven in the Fifth Symphony introduced them into concert music in the finale. And before the first rehearsal started, Tintner, who was this old Austrian maestro with a shock of grey hair, said to me very heavily accented, "First trombone, do you play the high F in the finale?" I hadn't even played a note, and I said, "Yes, I play the high F." And inside I'm thinking, I hope I can play the high F. I hadn't played a note with the orchestra, and I had to publicly declare my intention. That it was intimidating at the time, but hilarious in retrospect.
But you obviously did manage to play the high F, because your career blossomed after that.
Yes, I think I got lucky.
And where after Melbourne?
I was in Melbourne for 4 years, and one of the strong motivations for me joining that orchestra was extra musical, and that is I had a very close relationship with the horn player Gabriel Webster, who was already a member of the orchestra. We were together in the Australian Youth Orchestra, and it would have been my dream to end up in the same orchestra as her, and was lucky enough that it worked out. And we were in the orchestra there for 4 years, and we had, after that period of time, become aware of that point in time where you can see the rest of your life, and you're thinking, so this is a pretty good situation, and should we invest the rest of our lives here, or should we look further afield? So we had both thought about the possibility, since we joined so young, about doing a little bit more study and deepening our musicianship and our skills. So we had the idea to study overseas. But back in those days, it was difficult to take time away from the orchestra. And back then, the orchestras were administered federally from Sydney. So there was quite a bureaucratic, you know, to put it tactfully, there was a lot of bureaucracy to cut through, and it wasn't that friendly. And so we actually made the decision to have a clean cut, and we both resigned from the orchestra, since we couldn't find a friendly way of coming to an accommodation with the management. So we moved to Germany, and that was 1981, and my wife joined the Philharmonia Hungarica Orchestra, the famous orchestra that recorded all the Haydn symphonies with Antal Darati. They were resident there. Originally Hungarian refugees from the 1956 revolution, who were adopted first in Vienna and then by the Federal Republic of Germany. And I was lucky enough to win the solo trombone job with the WDR Symphony Orchestra. Back then it was called the Cologne Radio Symphony Orchestra. WDR, WDR, is the largest broadcaster in the country. country of Germany by virtue of its population. So there's a big music scene there. And I was a member of that orchestra for 7 years.
And so you went from the Melbourne Symphony to
Cologne,
the heart of Europe.
Absolutely.
Very different.
Big shock. Once again, Mr. Naive, I went there ill-prepared for the cultural shock. I didn't really understand the cultural difference between the informality of Australia and the relaxed mores of the way we live with one another and the more formal and more structured German life. And so our first couple of years there were kind of a rude awakening, you know, for some very, very simple things. If you show up to a German post office and they're about to close, they're probably not going to serve you, you know. In fact, we remember
that
once...
That still happens, by the way.
Yeah, I can remember we're always sending stuff back to our parents, probably garbage, but we're always sending these little things back. And so we went to the post office. Well, I remember we were too close to closing, and he said, no, Morgan, come back tomorrow. And then once we showed up with a package, and he looked at it, and looked very disappointed. He said, oh, I can't send that. You're going to have to do better. Go home, bring it back tomorrow, and wrap it properly. So, and other things too. For example, you know, as a young worker, you have to furnish a tax return, and one did that in Australia back then. You filled out the tax returns and you listed your expenses, but in those days you weren't required to have a receipt for everything. So the first time we came to do our taxes in Germany, the tax guy says, where are your papers? And so, what papers? Well, you've got all these expenses listed here, you know, you have to prove it. And I said, we have nothing. And I think that was way beyond his imagination that anyone could live in that way. It was just wrong.
Well, in a moment, we're going to fly off from Cologne to Chicago. But in the meantime, I think we should hear some music.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the slow movement of the piano concerto number 23 in A, Kirchhoff 488 by Mozart. Mitsuko Ushida was the pianist and also the conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. That was the choice of my guest, Michael Mulcahy. Michael, the reason for that choice?
Well, there's such soul in a movement like that. It takes you to a very private, deep place. You can, I don't want to trivialize it. It's very profound. And I tend to gravitate to music that is a little bit on the melancholy side. So I love the best of Mozart in every arena. But when something profound like this slow movement, or another great example is the opening of the Requiem. As soon as I hear those sounds, I'm transported beyond this earth to some other dimension, to something spiritual and deep, and something that goes beyond humanity somehow. There's some kind of dimension to it that is undefinable.
And you're right about those slow movements, both Mozart and Beethoven. They take you to places that you very deep, very profound.
Absolutely.
Talking about being transported, you went from Cologne to Chicago. How did that come about?
Well, there was a detour in between, actually. It wasn't a direct flight. So after 7 years in Germany, we were starting a family, and it was a very difficult decision, but we decided to leave Germany. And the reason was we thought that our children would have a nicer childhood growing up in Australia. So I came back for a teaching job in Canberra, and I was at the Canberra School of Music for 2.5 years. And at that point, I had really given up orchestra playing, and I was building a teaching studio there and getting more active as a recitalist. And then during my time, the Chicago Symphony toured Australia for Australia's bicentennial in 1988. And I knew some people in the orchestra there, so I went to one of their concerts at the Opera House. And then we decided to get together and play chamber music with the low brass players. And we had a great time, and they said, by the way, you know, we're going to have a vacancy, you should audition. And I didn't take it very seriously. It seemed such a long shot because there's an oversupply of great brass players in America. But subsequently to that, the bass trombone player wrote to me, and he wrote to me on August the 8th, 1988, which was a little bit curious because he doesn't write many letters, and you don't get many letters on the 8-8-88. So and he was very compelling. He said, you have to take this audition. And he said, warning you, it's going to be a hell of an audition, so you have to expect this and expect that and blah, 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 blah. When I got that letter, that changed my attitude, and I thought, well, the job that I'm auditioning for has not been vacant for over 50 years, so this is an experience I have to have. So I went over and I auditioned. I was well prepared, but I was one of many, many people, hundreds of people. And I was fortunate that I won the audition. It was quite the ordeal. Scholte had the last two finalists on stage at the same time, going back and forth, playing one excerpt, and then the other would play it.
No pressure.
And then we did the same thing with the section. The section sat down, and we took it in turns to sit in with the section. And anyway, I got the job, and so hence that's how I've spent the best part of the last 30 years in the Chicago Symphony. And by the way, I always like to mention that audition did happen on my birthday, so maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just good luck.
And that 8-8-88 was obviously a portent for the future.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's everything is very unlikely, and I feel very blessed. And sometimes when you get a little bit frustrated in your work, you forget how lucky you are to have the opportunity you have. And so when we're talking about this, it reminds me about so many turns in my life where I've been the beneficiary of such good fortune.
We're going to talk about some of those great conductors you've worked under in a moment, but in the meantime, let's hear some more music.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the 7th Suite, Opus 87 by Sir Edward Elgar, the Black Dyke Band. Michael, the reason for that choice?
I have great affection for the British brass band tradition. It was largely responsible for giving me my start in trombone and music. An original piece of Elgar's that was so good he later transcribed it for orchestra. And Elgar is one of those composers I grew up with. My parents loved Elgar. I love Elgar. Once again, it can be very soulful, and he was certainly himself prone to the melancholy. That speaks to me very, very greatly. So Elgar is really up there for me.
And you'd be in good company in this station, because we have several Elgar, shall we say, fanatics. Yeah. But that's another story. In Chicago, you played with some of the great music directors of the later 20th century, early 21st century. Talk to us about them.
Well, I was very fortunate to join the orchestra when Georg Scholte was still the music director, and the chemistry with him was very special. He didn't always enjoy a good chemistry with the European orchestras. He was known in London as the Screaming Skull, and if you look at some of the videos of him rehearsing the Vienna Philharmonic for his very famous recording of Wagner's Ring, I mean, he looks like a maniac, especially as a young person. He's so physically dynamic and so intense, so over the top. When I started with the orchestra, he was not a young man anymore, but he still had incredible vigor. He still had incredible discipline and drive. And he held the orchestra on a very short leash. There was no mucking around. His rehearsals were very structured, extremely organized, and his performances were very taut. In fact, I would write down the duration of each performance, and Scholte's performances would only vary by several seconds. There would never be a greater variation than 30 or 40 seconds. Whereas some other conductors who were more spontaneous had really dramatic differences in duration. But Scholte was someone who had great rhythmic vitality. He wanted very expressive playing, and he was famous for dramatic intensity, but he also, like all great conductors, he really appreciated the power of pianissimo, of the orchestra whispering, playing very, very softly. And so the CSO has a particularly large dynamic range. These days, many orchestras have the big stuff, but not that many orchestras have the really soft stuff. And we've had people like Scholte, who was our music director. At that point, our principal guest was Claudio Abbado. He was crazy about soft dynamics, and he would get almost inhuman soft dynamics. But in fact, all of the great conductors who I've subsequently worked with, particularly our music directors, have all been very strong on the orchestra, having very great soft control. And when people come in as extra players to play with the Chicago Symphony, or like me, when they join the Chicago Symphony, they're confronted with something they've not been required to do before. And it's a little intimidating. Also, because our hall is a little on the dry side, so it's not like the Musikverein in Vienna or the Konzertgebouw, where there's a warm, lush acoustic. Chicago's rather more lean.
What about Barenboim as a conductor?
Well, Barenboim is probably the most brilliant person I've ever met, probably the most gifted person I've ever met, and someone who, unlike Scholte, did not like to plan everything out. He liked to be much more spontaneous. One of the things I love about him is he's such a seeker. He's so curious, and he's so open to experimenting. And he's a very good joke teller. He's the best joke teller I know. He's a brilliant joke teller. But he also loves arguing. He just loves arguing. So he was very open to discussing how we were working and why. And he was very much in the Fort Winkler school that music becomes something in real time, that you can't kind of plan everything out. In fact, he would even ascribe to the view that he couldn't know the ideal tempo for a piece when he started it because he hasn't heard it yet. So he has to hear it, and then it will evolve. Now, I think that's a nice idea. If you're starting a Bruckner symphony that goes for 80 minutes, that's preposterous to me that you don't have a pretty good idea, especially if this orchestra was the orchestra you played with yesterday and it's the same piece and it's the same hall. But his performances were wildly different, and you had to pay attention because he would emphasize different things night to night. And I can remember I'd be sitting there as part of a tutti and we're all playing along, and suddenly he wanted something that I had, and he looked at me like a crazy man. And I know that if I wasn't paying attention, I'd be in trouble.
Well, we're going to hear another great conductor's recording now of a work you just referred to. It's the Bruckner Symphony No. 8. We're going to hear a short extract, and it's the Australian World Orchestra under Sir Simon Rattle.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the final movement of Symphony No. 8 in C minor by Bruckner, the Australian World Orchestra under Sir Simon Rattle. And that's a good segue into our next part of our chat with our guest today, Michael Mulcahy, who is here to perform, among other things, with the Australian World Orchestra. Michael, tell us a little bit about that. This is about the fourth time you've played with them.
Yeah, I've been out several times, and a couple of times with Zubin Mehta and with our own maestro, Riccardo Muti. The Australian World Orchestra is a miracle, really, that an opportunity for some of the finest Australian musicians from all around the world, as well as from within Australia, to convene for a few weeks and have a special season. And it has a special musical energy. It's a revelation to play with so many people that have so much in common and yet play in so many different places. A few, not very many from North America, a ton of people from Europe, a ton of people from Australia, and some people from Asia as well. And it's remarkable that we have something in common, given that our careers have taken us to very different places. And when I was approached about the possibility of Muti coming out, and I spoke to him about it, he made it very clear to me that he didn't like festival orchestras. He didn't like all-star orchestras. And so I convinced him that the people in this orchestra have something unique, and he knew some of them. Muti's been conducting in Vienna for 40 years, so he knew some of my friends in Vienna longer than I've known them. And he's obviously worked with a lot of Australian singers. And so the one thing I'll say about Muti is, if any of us orchestra members have projects, and I've had a few projects, he backs you 100%. So he's done, for example, we founded something called the National Brass Ensemble, which is a self-selected group of some of the finest brass players in America. And we recorded a big Gabrielli project, a little bit like the famous one that was done with the Chicago, Cleveland, and Philadelphia orchestras back in the, whenever it was. And I invited Muti to guest conduct that, and he launched the CD with us. So he was on board very quickly with AWO just by virtue of the fact that I vouched for it. And he came out, he had a spectacular time. Before he came, he said, well, it takes at least 6 months to establish the sound of an orchestra. And after about 3 days of rehearsing, he came to me and said, I think we found our sound.
That's a fabulous story. Let's talk about Anna, because you're also very heavily involved with them.
Yeah, that's another great blessing. For many, many years, I was very busy overseas and did very little in Australia. But both the Australian World Orchestra and the National Academy of Music in Melbourne have been wonderful opportunities for me to reconnect with Australian musicians, and particularly with the development of young musicians. And through the largesse of Anne Ronis, who sponsors my residency, and also that of Andrew Bain, who's the principal horn of the LA Philharmonic, we come out at least 3 times a year for a residency with some of Australia's most gifted young people. And it's a great opportunity for me to leave a little bit of a footprint here, because as exciting as performing is, and as great as some of the concerts are, it's very ephemeral. No matter how special it is to you today, tomorrow it's vanished into thin air. So even when you make recordings and things, everything gets superseded eventually. You know, Karajan was unassailable. And so much has happened since Karajan. So you get a sense of time passing, and eventually everything kind of fades. But Dale Clevenger, our longtime principal horn player, told me the one thing that you really have legacy with is your students, And so I've been teaching most of my life, but informally for a long time, until about 20 years ago when I started teaching at Northwestern University in Chicago. And I've built a very strong studio there, and many of my students are in major orchestras, Boston Symphony, San Francisco, Berlin Philharmonic. And so I've practiced teaching for a long time, and having taken it seriously for 20 years, I can bring a lot to Annam that I wouldn't have been able to bring without that deep teaching experience at Northwestern. So I feel just like performing, teaching, you have to practice, you have to learn. And it's not just a question of the fact that some people have a gift for it and some people don't, which is true, but like acquiring skills on an instrument, you have to acquire skills as a teacher so that you can bring people along and inspire them.
Michael, that's all we've got time for. It's such a shame because there's so much more ground we could have covered. I would love to have talked about your experience with some of the other great conductors. But anyway, thank you so much for coming into the studio. It's been a real pleasure, a real gift for us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
My thanks also to Stuart McMillan for producing this program. I'm Ted Davis, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Reflections on 3MBS Fine Music Melbourne.